from about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, October Halloween extravaganza. All this month, we were having a bit of fun with the topics for the podcast, so I hope that you enjoyed. Special thanks to my patrons who actually didn't vote for these Halloween episodes, but they still support me and my work, and I thank them so much. You are truly appreciated, guys. And for anyone else, please feel free to join my patrons so that you can vote on who will be covered next or get early access to the podcasts. Like, share, and subscribe. You know, it might just help our little community grow. So, small announcement really quick. This is the final podcast for this year's October Halloween extravaganza. I have really gotten an overwhelming amount of positive feedback this year, and it definitely warmed my black little heart. So thank you for taking the time to comment. Though the various outlets that offer my podcast don't really have an option for me to respond, just know that I see them and they make me smile. And I'm already thinking about what I'm going to do next year. But after this podcast, I'm going to take, you know, a couple of week mental break. One, because I just want to take a little break, but I'm also writing a book as well as working on a collab with someone, and I just need some time. But do not fear, my loves, as I will be back, and in the meantime, I have scheduled some reruns, if you will. So this is to keep you going until my return, which will be soon. But today's podcast will be on the history of Samhain. So, without further ado, pronounced Samhain, most scholars agree that within this ancient Celtic festival are the roots of my most favorite beloved holiday that most of us celebrate, Halloween. So let's learn a little bit about the history. The first references to the ancient Celtic pagans come to us from a Greek geographer in 517 BC, though the Greeks pronounced them Keltoi. He wrote about people residing on the southern coastline of France on the stunning Mediterranean Sea. In the 5th century BC, another Greek geographer and historian wrote about the Celtic people that lived in what is now Germany at the source of the Danube River, as well as Celtics living in the far western portions of Europe. The Kel portion of the word is theorized to have a few different origins, but most agree it means the tall ones, but could mean the hidden ones or being linked with the Germanic Hel, and Hel would become the name of the goddess of the underworld. Now, I consider myself an educated individual, and yet I hadn't realized that the Celtic people lived in a much more vast area than just Western or Northern Europe, as I had always thought. A map of where the Celtic people lived shows them in a large swath of Western Europe, from the predictable UK, Ireland areas into the Netherlands and Denmark, but then down through nearly all of Western Europe, including the biggest portion of Spain and nearly all of Portugal. They extended into northern Italy, Hungary, into modern-day Romania, and even as far down as to be into kind of Turkey. Again, I hadn't known that they had lived in such a vast area, so here we are, learning together. But more specifically, a study has now discovered that the Celts were actually descended from Iberian, meaning Spain and Portugal, fishermen who migrated north to Britain between 4000 and 5000 BC and are now considered the UK's indigenous inhabitants. Sources stated they were known as the Britons, or maybe Britons, also known as Celtic Britons or Ancient Britons, and they were the indigenous Celtic people who inhabited Great Britain from at least the British Iron Age until the High Middle Ages, at which point they diverged into the Welsh, Cornish, and Breton's Bretons, among others. And for reference, the British Iron Age was from about 750 BC to the early 1200s. I'm all about being able to sort of put a pin in these things on the chronological timeline in my head that I see. So the second most common clan arrived from Denmark during Viking invasions in the 9th century. They were descended from Viking invaders who settled in the British Isles from AD 793. Again, super interesting to me at least. I was surprised to find a lot of sources debating whether or not the Vikings became Celtic, or if they weren't a melting pot per se, and just lived beside each other. But there were a lot of passionate writings about how Denmark was wholly populated by the Celtic. And I don't think I really want to get into that debate, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. So getting into the history of the Celts is a subject for another time, but as far as this podcast goes, we are looking more at the religion of these people, Celtic paganism. According to most sources, there really aren't any ancient texts or native records of their beliefs that exist, so evidence about their religion is obtained and learned from archaeology, Greco-Roman accounts, though not always written in very positive light, and literature from the early Christian period. Celtic paganism was one of a larger group of polytheistic, meaning many gods, as opposed to monotheism, such as Christianity, meaning one god, Indo-European religions of Iron Age Europe. And for reference, the Iron Age was from roughly 1300 BC, or if you listen to The Curse of King Tut, from around he and his family's time, all the way to around just after the 1500s AD. The origins of Celtic paganism comes from Proto-Celtic paganism. They were very much interested in mythology, legendary, and folktales, including supernatural themes. They believed in deities, demons, specters, and more. They believed that there was an upper world, the other world, or what we would think of as the world of the dead, the world of the living, and then the lower world, or the deep. Other sort of reconstructed themes within proto-Celtic paganism involves victim offering, summoners and accusers, poetic inspirations, bards or poets, magical incantations, priests and druids, rites and ceremonies, magical transformations and shapes, ancient stones and funerary monuments, omens and devotion or religious practices, sacred objects and incantations and songs. We also see mentioned lightning and thunder, and more importantly, the hammer of the thunder god, huh? Right? So there is also secret and sacred magic, curses, I mean everything we think of regarding paganism. They served many deities, as most of us already know, and when I say they served many, I mean a lot of deities. Celtic deities can belong to two categories, general and local. General deities were known by the Celts throughout large regions and are the gods and goddesses called upon for protection, healing, luck, and honor. The local deities from Celtic nature worship were the spirits of a particular feature of the landscape, you know, such as mountains, trees, or rivers, and thus were generally only known by the locals in the surrounding areas. After precious Celtic lands became overrun by Christians, Christian writers began to change, try to meld into their own religious figures, or even demonize most of the pre-Christian deities, while a few others became saints in the church. Convenient. The Tuatha Dé of Irish mythology, who were commonly interpreted as divinities or deified ancestors, were downgraded within Christianity to, you know, at best, fallen angels or mere mortals, or even portrayed as demons. Kind of sad, honestly. But thankfully, various neo-pagan groups are claiming association with Celtic paganism. These groups range from the Reconstructionists, who work to practice the ancient Celtic religion with as much accuracy as possible, to New Age, eclectic groups who take some of their inspiration from Celtic mythology and iconography, the most notable of which is Neo-Druidry. But it is important to remember that, as I said, comparatively little is known about Celtic paganism because the evidence for it is fragmentary, due largely to the fact that the Celts who practiced it wrote nothing down about their religion. And before anyone asks, no, Stonehenge was not put together by the Celts. Stonehenge predates them, just so we're all clear. So what is Samhain, or Samhain? Well, it's a Gaelic word. It is a pagan religious festival originating from an ancient Celtic spiritual tradition. It marked the Celtic New Year. It is usually celebrated from October 31st to November 1st to welcome in the harvest and usher in, quote, the dark half of the year. Celebrants believe that the barriers between the physical and the spiritual world break down during Samhain or Samhain, allowing more interaction between humans and denizens of the other world. It is the time that the veil between our world and the spiritual one is at its thinnest. The ancient Celts marked this holiday as the most significant of the four quarterly fire festivals, according to the History Channel. So the four are, of course, Samhain, Imbolc, or the beginning of spring, Beltane, which is the midpoint between the spring equinox and the summer solstice, and Lunasa, which was a festival that celebrated the beginning of the harvest, roughly halfway between the summer solstice and the autumn equinox. The early literature says Samhain was marked by great gatherings and feasts and was when the ancient burial mounds were open, which were seen as portals to the other world that I mentioned earlier. So Samhain took place at the midpoint between the fall equinox and the winter solstice, or when summer goes to rest. During this time of year, hearth fires in the family homes were left to burn out while the harvest was gathered. And then after the harvest had been collected and completed, people who celebrated would then join in with the druid priests and gather around a community fire using a wheel that would cause friction and spark flames. The wheel was considered a representation of the sun and used along with prayers. Cattle were brought down from their summer pastures and some were sacrificed. And participants took a flame from the communal bonfire outside back to their home to relight their hearths. I mean, how charming. The History Channel went on to write that early texts present Samhain as a mandatory celebration lasting 3 days and three nights where the community was required to show themselves to the local kings or chieftains. Failure to participate was believed to result in punishment from the gods, usually illness or death. There were also a military aspect to Samhain, particularly in Ireland, with holiday thrones prepared for commanders of soldiers. Anyone who committed a crime or used their weapons during the celebration faced a death sentence. Some documents mention 6 days of drinking alcohol to excess, typically mead or beer, along with a gluttonous feast. But it is important to remember that the feasts and offerings and sacrifices were to appease the gods and the fae so that people and their cattle would survive the winter, fae meaning the fairies. And so again, the Celtics believed that during this very special time, the veil between the living and the dead was especially thin. This, in turn, allowed spirits of the dead to visit the living. And because of this, they prepared offerings that were left outside villages and fields for supernatural creatures such as fairies or shees. Now, Celts would also dress as animals and monsters so that fairies were not tempted to kidnap them. You see, side note, fairies are not the sweet little twinkling beings that Disney has led you to believe. You have to actually be careful with them. They really aren't to be trusted, but I know, I digress. But dressing up as something else to trick evil spirits is where we get dressing up for Halloween today. So some specific monsters were also associated with the mythology surrounding Samhain, including a shape-shifting creature called a puka that received harvest offerings from the field. The Lady Gwyn is a headless woman dressed in white who chases night wanderers and was accompanied by a black pig. The Dullahans sometimes appeared as impish creatures, sometimes headless men on horses who carried their heads, and again, we are all familiar with the headless horsemen. Riding flame-eyed horses, their appearance was a death omen to anyone who encountered them. Large bonfires would be lit to protect families from witches and, again, fairies. Other Samhain celebrations included the act of carving turnips called jack-o'-lanterns that began to appear, attached by strings to sticks and embedded with coal. Later Irish traditions switched to pumpkins, which we obviously still see today. In Wales, men tossed burning wood at each other in violent games and would set off fireworks. In northern England, men paraded with noisemakers, all to scare off evil spirits. The tradition of, quote, dumb supper began during this time, where food was eaten by the people who celebrated, but only after inviting their ancestors to join in, and thus giving the families a chance to interact with the spirits until they left the following dinner. Children would play games to entertain the dead, while adults would update the dead on the past year's news. That night, doors and windows might be left open for the dead to come in and eat cakes that had been left for them. But then, as Christianity gained a foothold within the pagan communities, church leaders attempted to reframe Samhain or Samhain as a Christian celebration. The first attempt was by Pope Boniface in the 5th century. He moved the celebration a whole 7 months away to May 13th and specified it as a day of celebrating saints and martyrs. The fire festivals of October and November, however, did not end with this decree, thank God. In the 9th century, Pope Gregory moved the celebration back to the time of the fire festivals, but declared it All Saints' Day on November 1st. All Souls' Day would follow on November 2nd. And thankfully, neither new holiday did away with the pagan aspects of the celebration. October 31st became known as All Hallows' Eve, or Halloween, and contained a lot of the traditional pagan practices before being adopted in 19th century America through Irish immigrants bringing their traditions across the ocean. Oh, how I love the Irish. Trick-or-treating is said to have been derived from ancient Irish and Scottish practices in the nights leading up to Samhain. In Ireland, mumming was the practice of putting on costumes, going door to door, and singing songs to the dead. Sometimes the dressing up was to impersonate the dead or spirits. Other times it was, again, to trick the spirits into not seeing who the person really was. Cakes were given as payment. Halloween pranks also have a tradition in Samhain. Though, in the ancient celebration, tricks were typically blamed on the fairies, those Anri Fae. So, Samhain, in essence, was a festival for the dead. As mentioned in several medieval texts, it is said that the festival of Samhain lasted a week, Samhain itself, and the 3 days before, and the 3 days after. It involved great gatherings at which they held meetings, feasted, drank alcohol, and held contests. With regards to specific food items, in Celtic mythology, apples were very strongly connected to or associated with the other world and immortality. One of the most common games was apple bobbing, which most of us are still quite familiar with. Apples were also peeled into one long string, the peel tossed over the shoulder, and its shape was said to form the first letter of your future spouse's name, and I find that fascinating. Another game involved hanging a small sort of wooden rod from the ceiling and stopping it at head height with a lit candle on one end and an apple hanging from the other. The rod was spun around and everyone took turns catching the apple with their teeth. Hazelnuts were connected with divine wisdom. In fact, two hazelnuts were roasted near a fire. One would be named for the person roasting them, and the other for the person they wanted or desired. It was said that if the hazelnuts jumped away from the fire and heat, that it was a bad sign. But if they roasted quietly, it foretold a good match. And then there were items that were actually hidden inside of food, usually inside of a cake or other items, and portions of it were served out at random. So a person's future could be told by the item that they just happened to get. So an example would be, say, a ring that might mean marriage. If you found a coin, then perhaps you would come into wealth. You get the idea. And yet another food tradition was that egg whites were dropped into water, and the shapes it created within the water might tell you how many children you could expect to have in the future. Young people would chase crows and pay attention to the number of birds or which direction they flew as ways of telling the future. People also took special care not to offend the spirits and sought to ward off anyone else who might be out causing mischief. Most stayed near to home or, if forced to walk out in the darkness, would turn their clothes inside out or even carried iron or salt to keep the spirits or fae at bay. In Southern Ireland, it was customary on Samhain to weave a small cross of sticks and straw called a parshel or parshal, which was similar to the Brigid's cross or God's eye. It was fixed over the doorway to ward off bad luck, sickness, and witchcraft, which would be replaced each Samhain. The dead were also honored at Samhain. The beginning of winter may have been seen as the most fitting time to honor the dead, as it was a time of dying in nature. In Scotland, young men went house to house with masked, veiled, painted, or blackened faces, often threatening to do mischief if they were not welcomed. Treat or you'll get tricked, so to speak. The blackened faces were created using the ashes from the bonfires for protection. So in parts of Southern Ireland, it was said that a man covered in a white sheet and carrying a decorated horse skull would lead a group of youths blowing on cow horns from farm to farm, each reciting verses, some of which, quote, savored strongly of paganism, and the farmer was expected to donate food. By doing so, he could expect good fortune from the Muc Alla. Not doing so would bring misfortune. This is akin to the Grey Mare procession in Wales, which takes place at midwinter. In Wales, the white horse is often seen as an omen of death. Elsewhere in Europe, costumes, mumming, and hobby horses were part of other yearly festivals. However, in the Celtic-speaking regions, they were, quote, particularly appropriate to a night upon which supernatural beings were said to be abroad and could be imitated or warded off by human wanderers, end quote. So, what happened to the Celts? In Celtic culture, women could hold the highest position in the social hierarchy. Women leaders were not uncommon. Other women were druidesses who specialized in political prophecy and played important roles in Celtic military campaigns. It was clear that Celtic women were occasionally allowed to take on the position of supreme authority, which was distinctly different from the Mediterranean world. The Greeks and Romans found that extremely odd, and yet, when the Romans conquered Britain in 43 AD under Claudius, the Celts were slowly defeated and Romanized, as many things were. But you'll be proud to know that they most certainly didn't go down with a fight, right? So there was an ancient and legendary Celtic queen named Boudica, who had been trained to be a warrior. She led a bloody revolt against the Romans in 61, in which her forces destroyed the Roman stronghold of Londinium and massacred the inhabitants, according to Roman sources. She actually destroyed several Roman settlements throughout the east of Britain. Before the revolt, she and her followers were patient, quiet, and waited for the perfect time to strike. It is believed that she actually delivered a speech to her people to gather support against the Romans. This was recorded by a Roman writer, and although modern historians believe it likely to be fictional, it is glorious all the same. It is believed that she said, quote, "On this spot we must either conquer or die with glory. There is no alternative. Though a woman, my resolution is fixed. The men, if they please, may survive with infamy," end quote. And I just love that. But the Celts were eventually defeated by the Romans, and what was left was all but obliterated by the Germanic tribes, the Slavs and the Huns. The 19th and 20th centuries have witnessed a Celtic revival in the British Isles, mostly driven by political anger over British rule in places like Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. My ancestors. I mean, politics do ruin everything, am I right? But musicians, artists, and authors like William Butler Yeats have very proudly embraced a pre-Christian Celtic identity. But the Celts were much more than just being an Irish or Scottish phenomenon, and so historians are divided over the accuracy of modern claims to Celtic heritage. But I am happy to see that there are Celtic reconstructionists who are not only bringing the old gods back, but are striving for accuracy. And guys, this concludes this year's October Halloween extravaganza. And like I said, I'm already planning next year's lineup. This is my most beloved time of year. Bugs go right back to hell where they belong, and the armpit of Satan himself that I live in all summer begins to subside. Again, I'm going to take a short break, but don't stress. I'll post some reruns. I'll still be on the socials. See, I'm trying to finish a book before next year's True Crime Fest, where I'll be a speaker next year. God help that audience. That's next August, so y'all have time to save up and come see us. It has grown exponentially. And then we shall see if CrimeCon picks me for next year as well. I'm also trying to plan a website that will go above and beyond. And I'm also in the process of reimagining merch from the ground up. So I've got a lot going on, okay? So just stick with me. We're going to get through this. Never worry. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. Because I know that you could be listening to anyone else, but you choose me. You keep choosing me. And I am humbled. I really appreciate you guys. Thank you so much. And have a fantastic Halloween.
Anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.